Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we had the Cambodian brinksmanship, which surprisingly resolved the country's months-long border dispute with Laos. The two ASEAN neighbors were locked in a bitter disagreement over a small stretch of territory ever since April, when approximately 30 Laotian troops entered a disputed area that Cambodia claims as its own in order to stop a road construction there. The standoff stayed out of the news for the most part until Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen delivered a powerful ultimatum at the end of last week, vowing to use military force to dislodge what he said were invaders if they didn't withdraw by the 17th of August. He also flew out to Laos to hold direct, face-to-face meetings with its leadership, and lo and behold, his brinksmanship paid off by getting the Laotians to pull back their forces in exchange for Cambodia doing the same. The issue will now be resolved by strictly diplomatic means without the use of force being applied. The reason why all of this is important to comment on is because it was the closest that two Chinese partners got in recent times to an all-out war between them. One which could have been very disruptive for Beijing's One Belt, One Road global vision of New Silk Road connectivity. Both Laos and Cambodia are privileged partners of the People's Republic, which envisions the former as an irreplaceable transit state for its ASEAN Silk Road high-speed railway to Singapore, while the latter is an important maritime stop and outsourcing location for Chinese entrepreneurs. There are also plans to build a so-called Central Corridor in the Greater Mekong subregion between China and the two countries, which would run parallel to the Mekong River and could possibly even include a rail route one of these days. All these factors are very important when it comes to furthering China's designs to more closely integrate itself with its neighbors, and everything could be unnecessarily complicated if these two Chinese partners went to war with one another over a seemingly random strip of jungle territory. However, there is a bit more than meets the eye to what happened here, and it deserves a brief explanation. Cambodia will be holding hotly contested elections next July, in which incumbent Prime Minister Hun Sen will be given a real run for his money by the opposition. Russian expert Dmitry Masyakov, writing for the New Eastern Outlook Journal 2 months ago, noted how well the opposition Cambodian National Rescue Party performed in the parliamentary elections that were held in early June, believing that they could pose a real electoral challenge to the ruling Cambodian People's Party next year. One of the reasons behind the opposition's appeal is that they're fiercely nationalistic and have expertly employed demagogic populism in the past to stir up their base. Cambodia previously had border disagreements with both Vietnam and Thailand, and the opposition regularly charges that Hun Sen sold out national interests by settling for compromise agreements with his neighbors. By being tough against Laos, however, Hun Sen attempted to disprove these accusations and chip away at the Cambodian National Rescue Party support base. It's still uncertain whether this gambit will pay off by giving him a convincing mandate after next year's election, but in any case, it goes to show how nationalist populism is becoming an ever more important factor in the domestic politics of Asian states. The next one up is the terrorist attack earlier this week in the Burkina Bay capital of Ouagadougou. A group of armed jihadists took over a Turkish restaurant in the city and ended up killing at least 18 people before the security forces put an end to the hostage ordeal. This isn't the first time that the landlocked West African state has been struck by terrorists, but Sunday night's attack corresponds to an uptick in regional violence, which has seen neighboring Mali hit over and over again all across its large, desert-strewn northeastern territory. Therefore, what's essentially happening in Burkina Faso is that the militancy in Mali is finally spilling across the border and threatening to spark a regional crisis. And all this is in spite of the French, African Union, and UN forces in the country. Paris decisively intervened in Mali in early 2013 in order to destroy a rapidly expanding caliphate that Al-Qaeda had created there after exploiting a Tuareg rebellion over the past year before, which itself was greatly aided by the free flow of weapons and fighters from NATO-wrecked Libya. Since that time, France has had difficulty keeping the peace in this bitterly divided country and has sought to outsource its leadership responsibilities to its regional partners, but to little avail. As the casualties mount and a combination of Islamic terrorists and Tuareg rebels continue to go on the asymmetrical guerrilla offensive, Mali looks more and more like it's becoming a West African version of what Somalia was in the 1990s. It was previously thought that Burkina Faso was one of Mali's most stable neighbors, But this illusion was shattered after the People's Uprising in 2014 overthrew long-term strongman Blaise Campore, and a counter-coup attempt by his loyal security service members was put down a year afterwards. Since then, observers began to become concerned about the fragility of this gold-rich, Muslim-majority country of 17 million people. Moreover, Burkina Faso occupies a very strategic role in hosting U.S. and French anti-terrorist military facilities, and its pivotal location at the geographic heart of the regional integration organization ECOWAS, or the Economic Community of West African States, means that it's primed to function as an important transit state for road and rail connectivity among the bloc's members. It's difficult to gauge the prospects of Burkina Faso becoming a jihadist battleground in the near future, but all indications point to Mali's many problems continuing to spill over its poorly guarded and highly porous border with its southern neighbor, which in turn risks encouraging mission creep by the US and France as they consider boosting their military presence there in order to protect their interests. As such, this also places them dead center in the heart of ECOWAS, and bestows them with unparalleled power to influence the bloc's integrational prospects in the future and possibly disrupt or control any of China's forthcoming new Silk Road plans for the region. Third in our countdown is the post-election unrest in Kenya. Not too many people are following this, but they should, because it concerns one of the best performing and most stable non-resource dependent economies in Africa. Kenya just held an important election last week in which incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta won a convincing 9% lead over his longtime rival Raila Odinga in a vote that was largely considered free and fair by international observers. However, Odinga, just like he did in 2007 when he narrowly lost by a much closer margin in which the international community at the time considered to be a disputed election, is now trying his luck at another color revolution in the hopes that he can force the authorities into making advantageous concessions to him and his party. However, the Kenya of 2017 isn't the Kenya of 10 years ago in 2007, and the electoral context is markedly different now than it was a decade ago, which makes Odinga's call for a strike and the protest by his supporters look much less legitimate than they did back then. The question thus becomes one of why this elderly politician wants to stir up another round of deadly domestic destabilization when he doesn't have anywhere near as convincing of a case to do so this time around. And while nobody knows the answer for sure, his irresponsible actions could nevertheless negatively impact on China's investments in the country. Kenya isn't just East Africa's most stable economy, it's also its most promising transit state. And it's for this reason why it plans to host two Silk Road projects. The first one is the Lamu Port, South Sudan-Ethiopia Transport Corridor, or LAPSET for short, and the second is the Standard Gauge Railway, which will run across the country and ultimately aim to connect Uganda, Rwanda, and potentially even the Congo to East Africa's largest port of Mombasa. However, if the country is wrecked by another round of ethno-tribal warfare, then the projects become less attractive to outside entrepreneurs, and it becomes possible for the aforementioned three countries to reroute their maritime connectivity plans through neighboring Tanzania instead. Remember, there's no proof that Odinga is deliberately destabilizing Kenya in order to harm China's projects, but the end result of his actions are still the same regardless of what's driving him. Furthermore, the instability inside the country could prompt Al-Shabaab terrorists in neighboring Somalia to carry out more attacks against soft targets across the border, which they have a regular history of doing anyhow. If East Africa's most stable country is thrown into chaos because of political disorder and resurgent terrorist threats, then it's bound to interfere with China's two Silk Road projects in one way or another, to say nothing of boosting the chances that unrest could spill across the region and catalyze the domino effect of destabilization elsewhere due to the neighboring country's inherent fragility and hybrid war risks. Our runner-up are the reports that Saudi Arabia is calling upon Iraq to mediate between itself and Iran. The Saudi news agency cited a source a few days ago after the news emerged who vehemently denied the veracity, but nevertheless, it's important to examine why this scenario is not only believable, but would also be very wise if it turns out to be true sometime in the future. Influential Shiite cleric and militiaman Muqtada al-Sadr just got back from a visit to the kingdom, which had tongues wagging all across the Mideast, with commentators unable to figure out why someone who would stereotypically satisfy all the characteristics of a Saudi opponent being feted as a high-level guest of honor by the royal family. I wrote about this in my analysis for The Duran, titled, "Is Iraq's Al-Sadr Going Saudi?" which postulated that one of the reasons behind the trip may have been that the centrally positioned country between Saudi Arabia and Iran was priming itself for mediating between its two great power neighbors, with one of its most symbolically important non-state actors, al-Sadr, crucially taking the lead in carrying this out. It's unclear at this moment what capacity, if any, al-Sadr could play in any possible mediation efforts sometime down the line, but nevertheless, the geostrategic logic behind having the pivotal middle ground country between Saudi Arabia and Iran mediate between them still holds, as it's Iraq, more so than any other state in the region, which holds the key to retaining the balance of power between these two rivals in the interior of the Mideast. Moreover, Iran and Saudi Arabia both have contiguous sectarian interests in Iraq as regards the Shiite and Sunni communities, respectively, and they're both concerned about what will happen in the aftermath of Iraqi Kurdistan's independence vote next month. The Kurd secession would leave the bitterly divided Shiite and Sunni communities together in an unstable rump state, without the balancing factor that their northern countrymen previously provided in keeping the country at least nominally united. Another Iraqi civil war between these two remaining groups isn't in Iran or Saudi Arabia's interest, but they might be drawn into this conflict unintentionally by the uncontrollable strategic momentum and security dilemma between each other. Iran would rather concentrate on safeguarding its interests in post-Daesh Syria, dealing with the rising Kurdish terrorist threat along its border region, and improving its economy. Likewise, the Saudis need to concentrate on their new Cold War with Qatar, drawing down their participation in the disastrous war on Yemen and initiating long-overdue socioeconomic changes through the ambitious Vision 2030 program, as well as weathering any potential political risks which may arise as a result between the ruling family and the Wahhabi clerics. In order to see to these much more pressing tasks, Iran and Saudi Arabia must find a temporary compromise in their Mideast-wide rivalry, as well as preserve the post-Kurdish territorial integrity and stability of a rump state Iraq, which is why it makes sense for Baghdad to take the lead in de-escalating tensions between Tehran and Riyadh, as this could hopefully, if it ever happens, find a way for both great powers to cooperate in keeping Iraq together as the most visibly tangible sign of any forthcoming detente. At our top spot, we've got the controversy surrounding Confederate monuments and their possible removal, and how this is contributing to the radicalization of both sides of the political spectrum. First off, let's get this out of the way. Yes, Confederate monuments do represent both slavery and the losing side of the Civil War, but they also stand for the state's rights cause, which has been enduring and refused to die even after 150 years. With the latest revival in this movement coming because of the U.S.'s never-ending culture wars. It may seem odd to non-Americans and even some people in the country itself why the U.S. even has Confederate statues in the first place, but that's just the way that American culture, especially in the South, evolved. The Confederate monuments are understandably polarizing in and of themselves, but the recent movement to tear down or replace many of them has become even more controversial for several reasons. The first is that not everyone who supports the U.S.'s Confederate heritage is a racist, with many people caring more about the cause of states' rights than hate speech, though it's unavoidable that racist, fascist, and white supremacists are drawn to Southern symbols for obvious reasons. Second, most of those who want to remove the statues likely have good intentions at heart, but they inevitably come up against a lot of opposition from people who allege that this is either historical revisionism or caving into liberals. About the latter point, it's lately become a popular trend for social justice warriors to pinpoint Confederate monuments and agitate for their removal, sometimes using the bullying tactics of Antifa and Black Lives Matter, or the threat thereof, to pressure local municipalities into complying with their demands. The visible presence of far-left movements advocating for the removal of the monuments and far-right ones standing in defense of them is an explosive combination that was bound to lead to violence between the two camps sooner or later. In addition, most members of either side are so-called moderates, meaning that they're not liberal bullies or hate-mongering racists, but are peaceful individuals who have legitimate points in support of their positions. Those in favor of the monuments want to preserve the memory of states' rights, which was unfortunately tarnished because it was applied to atrociously defend slavery, while opponents understandably feel uncomfortable seeing visible reminders of such a dark era and are passionate about having them removed. Regrettably, when the extreme minority on both sides capture nationwide media attention and clash with one another, like what happened in Charlottesville this weekend, this in turn radicalizes some of the moderate majority by making them think that most of their opponents are just as radical as those who they see on TV, leading to a cycle of violence that's difficult to escape from and which has no win-win solution. All right, folks, so this wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown. And as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for listening to my program. Hope you guys have a nice weekend and take care. Bye.